Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 372, titled, What's Going On Here, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 11th of 2002. In this broadcast, I'm going to attempt to illustrate a paradigm and to clarify further some of the political forces that are involved in the events in and around September 11th. This is a subject that I've been talking about for quite some time. I think that the events in and around September 11th are a good deal more complicated than has been presented in most analyses. And indeed, the working hypothesis that I've been presenting on this broadcast is an admittedly very complex one. I'm going to attempt to illustrate some of the types of relationships that I believe are involved not only in the events of September 11th, but also what I consider to be both a program of domestic subversion and an overt attack by a hostile foreign power, namely what I call the Underground Reich. As I've said in the past, I believe that the events of September 11th could be conceptualized as imagining what would happen if the forces that controlled Adolf Hitler were in the White House when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Also, I would consider the analysis that I presented in the past that rather than September 11th being a provocation, which a number of people have suggested, I think that the events of September 11th and the United States' situation in it could be compared with the situation of France prior to and during World War II. And I'm going to talk about relationships between the French power elite, specifically heavy industrialists, steel manufacturers in particular, and their opposite number in Germany, and how those relationships went counter to the French civic and political code. Listeners who find the line of analysis presented here complex should be aware that there are detailed descriptions of each program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. There will be a long, annotated, article-length description of For the Record 371 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website by later in the week. That is at www.spitfirelist.com. One word, SPITFIRELIST.com. And in addition to the detailed annotated article-length description in of each For the Record program, be aware that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, and there are links between the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and that and another URL maintained by WFMU, which has older programs available for download only. More about that later in the program. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look at a relationship that overlaps a number of the historical trends that I believe resulted in September 11th, and that in turn are precipitating a number of the events that are taking place on the world stage. In order to perhaps simplify the admittedly complex presentation that I'm undertaking, let me suggest two terms for people to keep in mind, structural relationships and conspiratorial relationships. What we're going to be examining in this program are some structural relationships that exist and have existed in the world of commerce, and then within those relationships, there are some conspiratorial processes that take place. So I want to distinguish between structural relationships and conspiratorial relationships which take place within the context of those structural relationships and which are enabled by those relationships, but are not coterminous with it. A metaphor to keep in mind would be the concept of a disease-carrying mosquito. When a mosquito that's carrying yellow fever or malaria bites a host, it's not biting the host in order to give it malaria or yellow fever. It is biting the host, of course, to get blood. But within the context of the structural relationship between the host and the mosquito, the disease is passed to the host. So that relationship, structural, is absolutely fundamental to, though distinct from, the process of pathogenesis and the communication of the disease. We could think of the relationship in this case between oil producers in Saudi Arabia in particular and the United States as constituting a structural relationship within which conspiratorial processes are taking place. And the situation of oil is inextricably linked with the process that's taking place, but yet that relationship, a structural relationship, is distinct from it. One could think of our situation here in the United States vis-a-vis oil as being like the host to a mosquito that will give us malaria and yellow fever at the same time. Those two diseases, and I'm speaking metaphorically, are terrorism and fascism. And I'm going to attempt to describe the structural and conspiratorial relationships and how the one is housed within the other. And specifically, I want listeners to consider the situation of the United States in 2001 and 2002 as being in many ways analogous to the situation of France in the pre-World War II and World War II period. France was attacked from without by an enemy, Nazi Germany, and at the same time it was being subverted from within by a fifth column, which was rooted in part in economic relationships between German industrialists and financiers and their counterparts in France, and which in turn resulted in a fundamental conflict between political life and the military life in France, and these structural economic relationships which ultimately brought France down in World War II. It was attacked from without and subverted from within. I would note that as looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M60, there was an abortive fascist coup in France in 1938 in which French fascist groups, chiefly the cagoulards or hooded ones, attempted to overthrow the French coalition government that existed under Léon Blum. This was a democratic coalition government that included, among others, the French Communist Party. As such, it was deeply despised by many of the powerful elements in France, and many of them saw fascism as an antidote to French democracy. I'm not suggesting there's any such thing as a perfect historical analogy, but again, considering the U.S. in 2001 and 2002 as being analogous to France, and some of the structural relationships between our enemies and some of the powerful economic and industrial interests in the United States, is, I think, an important one to understand, and it is, as I said, analogous. San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, August 6th of 2002 had an article from the Washington Post, this authored by Thomas E. Ricks, R-I-C-K-S. It deals with a country that is supposedly our friend, which has strong structural business relationships not only to the United States but to specifically the Bush administration, and yet this country is our deadly enemy. Much has been made of the fact that 14 of the 19 hijackers were of Saudi extraction. I have noted in the past the historical tributaries linking the development of fascism and the development of the Saudi state, and people who are linked to both, Ibn Saud and Alan Dulles, in turn linked to the Bush family. In addition to the fact that most of the hijackers were Saudis, the profound indications of the most formal and fundamental links between the Saudi elite and powerful Saudi sheikhs, the Saudi royal family, and al-Qaeda, well, those relationships are fundamental and at this point undeniable, but they are being ignored. And consider the fact that a country that's supposedly our ally and that is supposedly helping with the war on terror launched an attack on the United States, attacked the Pentagon, killed more Americans in the World Trade Center than died on Omaha Beach at D-Day, and yet Crown Prince Abdullah, the heir to the Saudi throne, visited Bush in Texas and was basically fawned over. It sort of makes Chamberlain's capitulation to Hitler at Munich look like a point, an element of resistance. Saudi Arabia and the U.S., an assessment different from what one will hear from the Bush administration, was presented to the RAND Corporation by an expert called Laurent Mouraouiec, M-U-R-A-W-I-E-C. I may be mispronouncing that. He described Saudi Arabia as follows. A briefing given last month to a top Pentagon advisory board described Saudi Arabia as an enemy of the United States and recommended that U.S. officials give it an ultimatum to stop backing terrorism or face seizure of its oil fields and its financial assets invested in the United States. Quote, "The Saudis are active at every level of the terror chain, from planners to financiers, from cadre to foot soldier, from ideologist to cheerleader," stated the explosive briefing which was presented July 10th to the Defense Policy Board, a group of prominent intellectuals and former senior officials who advise the Pentagon on defense policy. Quote, "Saudi Arabia supports our enemies and attacks our allies," unquote, said the briefing prepared by Laurent Mouraouiec, a RAND Corporation analyst. A talking point attached to the last of 24 briefing slides went even further, describing Saudi Arabia as the kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent, unquote, in the Middle East. Skipping down. Mouraouiec said in his briefing that the U.S. should demand that Riyadh stop funding fundamentalist Islamic outlets around the world, stop all anti-U.S. and anti-Israeli statements in the country, and, quote, prosecute or isolate those involved in the terror chain, including in the Saudi intelligence services, unquote. If the Saudis refuse to comply, the briefing continued, Saudi oil fields and overseas financial assets should be, quote, targeted, unquote, although exactly how was not specified. Well, as we've looked at in a number of programs, there are not only the most profound connections between the Saudi elite and al-Qaeda, but in turn between the milieu of Osama bin Laden and the milieu of George Bush. And it is some of the structural business relationships which exist between petroleum-related elements in the United States, some of their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, and that in turn, those structural relationships bind the bin Laden interests to those of the Bush family and beyond that, the Republican Party. And it is this structural economic relationship that in turn nurtures the Islamo-fascist and, I believe, underground right conspiratorial processes in which a fifth column in the United States has literally undermined this country. And who knows, in the event of another major terrorist incident, perhaps a nuclear incident, we could very easily see the shadow government that we've been told is waiting in the wings taking place. That in the event, for example, that Congress should get nuked. I've never heard anybody discuss who this shadow government is, who the members of this government are. But one should keep some of the possibilities in mind as one assesses some of the powerful interests not only behind al-Qaeda, but also lurking within the Bush administration. In the past, we've talked about Talat Otman, a director of Harkin Energy, a member of the audit board of Harkin Energy in the deal that George W. is now being scrutinized for. Talat Otman and Alan Quasha were on the audit board of Harkin Energy, and both also figure in the milieu of BCCI, and Talat Otman, in turn, interceded on behalf of some Islamo-fascist elements, Muslim organizations. Otman was representing them as Muslim organizations, but these are organizations that overlap the milieu of al-Taqwa and al-Qaeda. Their assets were seized in a Treasury Department raid on March 20th. Talat Otman, on April 4th, interceded with Treasury Secretary O'Neill on behalf of this al-Qaeda slash al-Taqwa milieu. I would also note that Talat Otman is the protege of Abdullah Taha Baksh, and also through Baksh, B-A-K-H-S-H, of Gayit Faron of BCCI fame. And the BCCI milieu, Harkin Energy, and the milieu of the bin Laden family inextricably linked. In order to examine the links between powerful interests in Saudi Arabia, the energy industry and petroleum industry in the United States, and Al-Qaeda. I would recommend, among other books, Forbidden Truth, subtitled U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden, co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquet. This book was published in softcover by Thunder's Mouth Nation Books, copyright 2002. We've talked about this book in, among other programs, For the Record 337 and 355. This is the book that accesses the late John O'Neill's assessment that his investigation of Al-Qaeda on behalf of the FBI was actively frustrated by American corporate connections to Saudi Arabia and the oil business, and that that blocked investigations into the Saudi funding of Al-Qaeda. ISBN number for this book is 1-56025-414-9. And in order to understand why a country could be a deadly enemy of the United States, launch attacks in the way that Saudi Arabia did, even attacking the Pentagon itself, and yet be treated with kid gloves, as Saudi Arabia has been, it's important to understand some of these structural relationships instead of the mouthpiece or the proboscis of, I guess it would be the mouthpiece of a disease-carrying mosquito. We've got the gas nozzle in our flesh, and that is the structural relationship which is allowing a lot of this to take place. Talat Otman and his connections to George Bush. In 1987, an obscure Saudi financier named Abdullah Taha Baksh invested in Harkin, a Texas oil company of which George W. Bush was a director from 1986 to 1993. The deal consisted of recapitalizing the company, which was going through difficult times. This Saudi investor is none other than the partner of Khalid bin Mahfouz and Gayit Faron of BCCI. And so, Taha Baksh became an 11.5% shareholder in Harkin Energy Corporation. His representative within Harkin Energy is not unknown either. Talat Otman is a member alongside Frank Carlucci of one of America's most prestigious think tanks, the Middle East Policy Council, as well as being a leading Arab-American supporter of the Republican Party. And note again that Talat Otman, as discussed in For the Record 356 and 357, we came back to this in number 358 and 9, note that Talat Otman interceded with the Department of the Treasury on behalf of organizations that had had their assets seized, and that those organizations overlapped the milieu of not only Al-Taqwa, but also the milieu of Al-Qaeda and the bin Laden family, and also the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. More about the relationship between the bin Ladens and the Bushes, Talat Otman and Abdullah Baksh. Turning once again to Forbidden Truth, between 1976 and 1982, Abdullah Taha Baksh, an investor in Harkin Energy, recall, was the representative for the bin Laden family in the United States. He also represents Khalid bin Mahfouz's financial interests in the Middle East. What's more, several sources emphasize the fact that he represents the interests of Khalid Salem bin Mahfouz on the board of directors of InvestCorp. In fact, bin Mahfouz holds a 25% stake in InvestCorp thanks to Baksh's services. And again, one of Baksh's proteges, Talat Otman, a director of Harkin Energy and someone who intervened on behalf of elements targeted by the Treasury Department as supporters of Al-Qaeda. And Talat Otman himself overlaps the milieu of Al-Taqwa, as we looked at in For the Record 356. By way of further developing some of the structural economic relationships within which certain subversive and pro-fascist conspiratorial processes can be nurtured, we're going to take a look now at the relationship between powerful French steel producers and economic interests in France and their counterparts in Germany, and we're going to take a look at the fundamental conflicts between French national and French national security policy in the pre-World War II and World War II period, and the economic relationships between powerful French industrialist steel producers in particular, and some of their counterparts in Germany. There was a steel cartel in France and Germany. In France, it was called the Comité de Forge. The Lorraine section of France has a lot of iron ore and produces a lot of steel. It, in turn, had traditionally gotten coal from the Ruhr district of Germany. A lot of coal is used in the production of steel. And so the relationship between the coal producers of the Ruhr and the Saar district in particular and French members of the Comité de Forge led to a French German industrial axis that, in fact, was used to subvert France, both politically and, as we will see, militarily, prior to and during World War II, because many of these interests were more concerned about profits, and in particular, they were worried about the possibilities of a democratic coalition government involving members of the French Communist Party. That, in fact, took place under Léon Blum. It was called the Popular Front. The Social Front, excuse me, of Léon Blum. What we're going to look at now is the book All Honorable Men. I've used this book in the past. It's authored by James Stewart Martin, who was in charge of the Economic Warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II, and then was in charge with the task of decartelizing not Germany after the fall of Hitler. He was, in fact, frustrated in his efforts to do that by some of the same Wall Street industrialists and financiers who had helped to build up Hitler in the first place, and in fact, of the relationship between the Thyssen interests that you're going to hear about and between the Union Banking Corporation and the Bush family were one of the relationships that we've explored as not only giving rise to or helping to give rise to fascism in Germany, but also helping to move the engines of the Underground Reich in the post-World War II period. We took a look at that in For the Record 370. Now, of the relationship between the Comité de Forge and German industrialists of the Saar, the relationship between the iron ore of Lorraine and the coal of the Saar being a central one here, we're going to take a look at this structural relationship within which a conspiratorial process subverted and ultimately defeated France in World War II. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men, published by Little Brown and Company in 1950. The horizontal separation of private interests from government policies went even further, this, by the way, referring to France. The struggle of the interwar period, that means between World War I and World War II, the struggle of the interwar period was not simply a clash between French interests on the one side and German interests on the other. During the development of the Ruhr-Lorraine industrial complex, like-minded industrialists in France and Germany had become directors of jointly owned and jointly controlled financial, industrial, and distributing enterprises. In many cases, common views on questions of economic organization, labor policy, social legislation, and attitude toward government had been far more important to the industrialists than differences of nationality or citizenship. After 1870, the interdependence of the French and German iron and steel industries led the owners to work together despite national differences, although the private activities of the French owners were in many instances in direct opposition to French public policy. It is curious to note that only the French appeared to have this conflict between public policy and private activities. On the German side, complete coordination seems to have been preserved between national and private interests, between officials of the German Republic and the leaders of German industry and finance. During World War I, the De Vendels, the influential French-German banking and industrial family which headed the French wing of the international steel cartel through their Comité de Forge and whose members had sat in the parliaments of both France and Germany, were able to keep the French army from destroying industrial plants belonging to the German enterprises of the Rohkling family. This is actually during World War I. These plants were located in the Brie Basin, a Lorraine ore field then in German control. The Rohkling family, that's R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T-C-H-L-I-N-G, the Rohkling family, with their powerful complex of coal, iron, steel, and banking enterprises in Germany, has for generations played in close harmony with the French De Vendel family. For a century, the descendants of Christian Röckling have dominated the industry and commerce of the Saar Basin. It was Hermann Röckling who arranged the return of the Saar to Germany in the plebiscite of January 1935 by organizing the Deutsche Front, which delivered 90% of the votes to the Nazis. Though 72 members of the Röckling family have survived two world wars and are still active in the business of the Saar today, two other members of the family, Hermann and his brother Robert, deserve a special place in history. During World War I, Hermann, a cavalry captain in the German army, and Robert, a major, had been put in charge of production in the Brie Basin. After the war, when the brothers Röckling moved out of the areas which had to be ceded to France under the treaty, the two of them carried away bodily a couple of large steel plants. Conceiving this grand larceny to be something in the nature of a war crime, the French government tried the brothers Röckling in absentia and sentenced them to 40 years in prison. But the German government never would give up the Röcklings to the French. For the next 22 years, the brothers were under this cloud as far as the French government was concerned. On the other hand, as far as the French Steelmakers Association, the Comité de Forge, and in particular the de Vendels who headed the committee were concerned, business as usual, or in this case, business as unusual, prevailed. In the end, even the French government weakened for business purposes, though the war crime sentence remained. When it came time for France to build its impregnable Maginot Line, who should be called in to supply steel and technical assistance but the German firm of the brothers Röckling? If the French behaved in this case, as did the Americans during World War II in the case of insurance coverage on war plants, they doubtless placed plenty of guards to protect the security and secrecy of the Maginot Line construction from the prying eyes of the general public, while the blueprints rested safely in the hands of the only people to whom they mattered, to wit, the enemy. Now comes the outbreak of World War II. The French army marching into the Saar during the phony war period in 1939 received orders not to fire on or damage the plants of the war criminals, unquote, the brothers Röckling. In 1940 came the Blitz and the fall of France. The Vichy government passed a decree exonerating the Röcklings and canceling their 40-year prison sentences. So note the relationship between the de Vendels and the Röcklings preserved the Röcklings in two world wars. We're going to examine this relationship and the analogies between the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in the second half of this program. There will be a detailed annotated article-length description of For the Record 371 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website later in the week. That's at www.spitfirelist.com. And in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there are links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM that have the For the Record programs on real audio. WFMU.org/Dave Emery has more recent programs streaming on real audio, and there's another longer URL linked to both the WFMU and Spitfire websites with older programs available for download only on real audio. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 372, What's Going On Here, part three, being recorded on August 11th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.